Hello, this is Bob Proctor with the seventh lesson from the Lead the Field seminar, It's Easier to Win. Earl Nightingale began by saying, "All kinds of studies have been made regarding motivation. What is it that motivates people to do the things they do, live the way they live, achieve the goals they achieve?" And while there is certainly no single answer to so large and complicated a question, I believe the overriding force which motivates us as persons is a thing I call choice of environment. Environment being the immediate world by which we are surrounded. Some people make this choice consciously, but I'm certain the great majority of people make the choice unconsciously as a result of environmental conditioning. As an example, consider the statistics regarding the financial condition of men and women over age 65. The median income of people over 65 is less than $50 a week, far below the poverty level. Yet, if a working person saved only a dime out of each dollar he or she earned, and if that person never made more than $6,000 a year in their entire life, they would save $24,000 by the time he or she reached the age 65. At average interest rates, it would amount to $58,909.80. This sum of money would certainly represent financial independence to the average worker at age 65. Add adequate life insurance to this amount, and he or she will also have provided financial independence for his or her spouse. Now, why, according to statistics, do only about 5 people out of 100 achieve financial independence during their lifetime? Why are only 5 motivated to achieve financial independence, something which almost everyone will tell you he or she wants to achieve? The questions Earl Nightingale is asking here must be answered, and they must be answered by you if you hope to live a balanced, healthy life. Well, the figures that he quotes are almost comical, they're so low. Understand they were very accurate at the time he shared this information with us in the early 60s. It wouldn't have been comical for the person who was living on that kind of income. If you were to take the time and go to the necessary source, you would find that the income for individuals 65 years of age and over has not really changed much. Although the numbers may be very different, their buying power would be very much the same. I think the point Earl Nightingale is stressing in this lesson is one that you and I must give serious thought to, and that is that most people are a product of their environment, and that the masses of people historically have never saved money and end up as poor old people because they were poor young people who grew old without ever changing their situation. By following the exercises in this program, you can break away from the crowd and catapult yourself into that select 3% of the population who enjoy the abundant life. Years ago, I attended a function where Earl Nightingale was the guest speaker. He said something that I shall never forget. "The opposite of courage is not cowardice. It is conformity." You might play with that idea for the next 50 years when you're making decisions and see how it improves your life. Let's return to Earl Nightingale's words as he elaborates on the power of environment and why so many people feel boxed in. Earl said, "Well, it's here we begin to see motivational forces at work. Motivation is closely linked to environment. Our normal reaction to environment is to act, think, and talk like the people by whom we're surrounded. Since only 3% achieve financial independence during their lifetime, the odds are 97-3 that in any given case, a person is surrounded by those who are not thinking and working towards financial independence. Instead, he or she is surrounded by, and as a result conforms to, a group which does not stress the importance of being financially independent." And I'm using finances as only one example. Other examples could be education, health, language, work, attitude, and so forth. These people can be said to be those people who do not consciously choose their environment, but simply go along with the environment in which they find themselves. Now, that would be fine if the statistics were reversed. If 97% of the people could be said to be successful, the odds would be excellent if we just went along with the crowd. In that event, selecting an environment might not be too important, but this is not the case and never has been. If a person does not choose of their own volition the environment in which he or she wants to live and raise their children, the chances are about 97-3 that neither he or she or their children will live in an environmental climate offering the best opportunity for success and enjoyment of life. When I worked with Earl Nightingale years ago, this lesson made a real impact upon my life. I began to look at the people that I did associate with, the business people that I hung around with most often, because I started to become aware that I was like them. I would like to suggest that you pause for a moment, stand back objectively, and take a look at the environment you now find yourself in. Make a list of 10 or 12 people that you associate with most frequently. Then, I want to suggest that you think about each of these people, one at a time. What are they like? I'm not suggesting that you question their character or integrity. Without being judgmental, ask yourself, do they entertain big ideas? Are they exciting and positive individuals who see the unlimited potential in all situations? Are they high achievers? And finally, a beautiful question, if you have children, would you like your children to grow up and conduct themselves in business like these people do? The truth is, they could be beautiful people who are going nowhere, and if you spend a lot of time with them, I can assure you, if you are not already like them, you are moving in that direction. After thinking about each of these individuals, pick six who you honestly feel could teach you something valuable, and select the ones you would like to emulate. Place a check mark to the right of that person's name. I once heard someone suggest that if you want to play a better game of golf, you should quit playing with your friends. There's probably a bit of truth in that. You know, Samuel Johnson said the greatest benefit which one friend can confer upon another is to guard, excite, and elevate their virtues. We want to look for professional advisors. When you need advice or information, go to the experts. That's a cardinal principle. Everyone should know well at least two or three very capable people in their business or industry to whom they can refer for experience and guidance. Now, when you're making your list of the people that you associate with, list six people who are acknowledged experts in your field who you'd like to emulate. Then ask yourself, how am I going to gain an introduction to two or three of these people who I would like to emulate? When am I going to have an introduction to them? Set a date. How can you cultivate a friendship with them after you've been introduced? Now, these are questions that I would suggest you take the time to sit down and seriously ask yourself. And put the names on paper, and then follow through on it. Develop a friendship with these people that makes a big difference in your life. You see, it was listening to the Lead the Field program that caused me to do this many years ago. After doing it and playing with these ideas for a long time, I decided I wanted to be associated with Earl Nightingale and his partner Lloyd Conant. I got on a plane, went to Chicago, and I just sold them on the idea that I could help their company. And I spent 5 wonderful years working with Lloyd Conant and Earl Nightingale. They became my mentors. So let's go back and listen to what one of my mentors had to say. Earl Nightingale said, "Let's take a hypothetical case and call him an average person in the free world. Although there's no such thing as an average person, the trouble comes from acting as though we are average. In the case of this so-called average person, from the time they're born until about age 25, most of their life is spent in doing what others have told the person to do. As a child, it's his or her parents, and they mold the child much as a potter molds clay. The child talks as the mother and father talk. He or she thinks the way they think. If they think something is bad, the child thinks it's bad. The child tends to grow up in the religious faith, and very probably, ultimately, in their political party. If they have deep-rooted prejudices, the child will likely adopt them. When the child reaches school age, he or she will begin to emulate the other children. To a youngster in school, the most important thing on earth is to be liked. Acceptance and esteem in the eyes of his or her contemporaries is the child's deepest craving. So he or she will do what the others do. The child dresses as they dress, wants to belong, wants to be liked. But remember, the child is following people who do not know any more than they do. He or she is not playing follow the leader. He or she is playing follow the follower. Every time I come to this particular part of the Lead the Field seminar, I have to go back in my own life because I was 26 when I first heard Lead the Field. And as I got to this particular section, I honestly thought Earl Nightingale had been reading my mail. It was so biographical. As he leads us through a scenario of how a young person grows up and goes in the service, it is exactly what I did. So as I share this with you, I want you to realize that this isn't some mythical character. This is really very real to me. Now permit me to recite Earl Nightingale's version of the story. He begins by asking us a question. He said, "Do you recall what Willie Loman said in Arthur Miller's play, Death of a Salesman? He said, the important thing is to be liked. Willie Loman had never grown up. Of course it's important to be liked. But this is only one part of life. To Willie, it was everything. And his ignorance of life and of the world brought him frustration and despair. But a boy in school, on average, being liked and doing what the other boys do is the most important thing in the world. And this vice-like pressure of conformity lasts for many years. Out of school, our young man may go into the military service. Here again, he's gripped by a vice of conformity far greater even than he's known in school. He still acts like the other fellows and talks and thinks much as they do. And now he even looks exactly like them. Same shoes, same clothes, same actions, everything. He becomes a unit in a thing called the military. And while that's the way things have, unfortunately, had to be, the effect of such standardization is, of course, enormous. Now let's say our young man is 25, out of school, out of the service. He goes back to his hometown, unless he's married, in which case he usually goes to live in his wife's hometown. But let's say he's still single. For the first time in 25 years, he finds himself really on his own. He must make a decision as to what to do, and it's a little frightening. One day he's standing on a corner, not knowing what to do, when he's met by an old friend from his school days. And the friend asks, "What are you doing?" "Nothing." "Why don't you come down and go to work where I work? It's a good job, the pay's regular, 40 hours a week, fringe benefits, the whole thing." So he does, and that's often the end of him. By taking the job suggested by his friend, he's still going along with the gang, but he's also giving less attention to the selection of a career than he would give to selecting a shirt or a necktie. On the job, what's the most natural thing in the world for him to do? It's to continue to go along with the gang. He's been doing it for 25 years. Why should he change now? So on the job, he looks around to see how the other fellows are doing their work, and he begins doing his the same way. You see, no one had told him that he's living in the golden age that mankind has been dreaming of and building towards for thousands of years. No one has told him that from now on out, what happens to him will be in his hands, not his parents, not his teachers, not his commanding officers, not his associates. But it's all up to him from here on out. He has before him perhaps a half a century or more in the greatest age the world has known. Now, what's he going to do with his most productive years? Well, with the steady job, he can marry his girl, which he does. He then often goes out to a large suburban development and buys a house or rents an apartment that's very much like every other house or apartment on the street. For as far as the eye can see, makes him feel comfortable. He belongs. What he actually does is disappear again, as he did it in the classroom and in the service. He has a steady job, a wife, a place to live, a new car, the biggest paycheck and the highest standard of living the world has ever known. A wonderful start in life. Now, what does he do? Well, he works 40 hours a week. This leaves him 72 hours a week when he's neither working nor sleeping. 72 free hours a week, almost twice the time he spends on the job, earning a living for his wife and future children. What does he do with his free 72 hours a week? As a rule, he'll do the same thing the other fellows are doing with their free 72 hours a week. He doesn't do much of anything with them. On a typical afternoon, he quits work right on the dot and drives his little car to his abode. He goes into his little kitchen, kisses his wife, and says, "I'm tired." It's believed he says this because he used to hear his father and his grandfather say it in the days when men actually worked hard enough to get tired. The wonderful technological advances, which have given him freedom from backbreaking toil and grinding poverty, permit him to retain just that much more energy and good health. After dinner, as likely as not, he will devote the rest of the evening to watching television. In this way, he's able to lose himself in worlds he must believe to be more interesting than his own. What he's actually doing is watching other people earn excellent incomes in the pursuit of their careers. Well, he doesn't make a nickel, and well, his most valuable possession, time, is silently slipping away. All too frequently, he doesn't know how fortunate he is. He doesn't realize that for the first time in all the difficult centuries of man, he no longer needs to work from early morning until late at night, 6 days a week. He has free time, lots of it, and he takes for granted a great many luxuries, which are the wonder and envy of three-quarters of all the human beings on earth. Furthermore, he can actually decide for himself what he wants to do with his life. He knows how to read and write, and all the great books of the world are available to him at his local library. In short, he usually takes for granted all the wonders that have been given to him. And with all of this, he lives a minimal existence, doing no more than he has to do to get by without too much discredit, hoping that times remain good so he can keep his job. He thinks it's only natural that his company, his town, and his country should continue to improve, expand, and advance. But somehow, he seems to believe it's not necessary for him to do likewise. Why does he live this way? Because this seems to be the way the rest of the fellows are living. And if they're living that way, he feels it must be right. Here is a case of mass motivation, of playing follow the follower. That was so biographical, it's almost scary. Fortunately, I woke up a year after I got caught in this trap, or I realized I was caught in this trap. Earl Nightingale makes reference to mass motivation. I think this is an excellent opportunity for us to find out what that really means. We're dealing with seven levels of awareness in life, and mass awareness is one of those levels. Now, let's take a look at each of these levels one at a time. Earl Nightingale has done a masterful job in painting the picture of this hypothetical individual and the ridiculous existence that he is experiencing that he calls life. He then points out that his reason for living this way is mass motivation. As you take a close look at the graphics in your management guide, you'll see the levels of awareness and see where mass motivation fits in. It is only one level above animalistic consciousness. The fact that a person even gets along as well as they do is a little surprising. From a creative perspective, they're not really much better off than their pets. On the first level, the animalistic level, it's fight or flight, putting an individual in a reactionary mode throughout their life. The next level, mass consciousness, is the one Earl Nightingale made reference to. This is where an individual, without thinking, steps into the crowd and obediently follows wherever the crowds lead. Let's stop right here and examine what is happening from a psychological perspective. To do this, it'll be necessary to revisit the image of the stick person. Remember where we said the top half of the mind was the conscious mind, the bottom half the subconscious. Now, of course, it's not top half, bottom half, as I've mentioned on many occasions, but that's the picture. Well, you see, the conscious mind has a vertical line running right down through the center, dividing it into two parts. The conscious mind reasons both inductively and deductively, while the subconscious mind is totally deductive. Inductive reasoning is where we go from the specific to the general. In other words, we think a thought, we add to it another thought, then another thought, and as we keep adding thoughts, we build the idea. This, in truth, is what is referred to as thinking. The inductive reasoning factor in the personality is what we think with. When it is not working, the mind is in a totally deductive state, and the personality is totally subjective to whatever thoughts or ideas happen to be present. Now, deductive reasoning is where we go from the general to the specific. Let's imagine that you are out visiting someone. You're having a nice evening, but you or your spouse looks at your watch and realize it's time to go home. The order is given to the mind to go home. Everything that has to be done to get home will be expressed at one at a time. You get up and you get out of your chair. You will go to your car. You put the keys in the ignition, etc., etc., etc. Every action that's necessary will be expressed to complete the command to go home. Consider for a moment what kind of actions a person would be involved in where there was nothing but ideas of lack, limitation, jealousy, resentment, and blame circulating in the environment that a person found themselves surrounded by with their subconscious mind wide open almost all of the time. I know you would agree it would be nothing short of a miracle for a person in that position to become aware of the cause of their results and to alter their conditioning and improve the quality of their life. Although the odds may not be in a person's favor, there are people who do it. And, more important, anyone can. If we were just to touch on the other levels of awareness before we get back into this lesson, how does a person get out of this? Well, they move to the third level, which is aspiration. They aspire to live better than they're living. They may see someone else doing it, they may read about it, or, as in my case, they may listen to Earl Nightingale's Lead the Field program, and it does inspire them. And we hit this point of aspiration. It's a level of awareness. We aspire to be more than we are, and so we do move ahead. We step out of the crowd. We get out of the box. We move ahead. This is where Abraham Maslow said you'll either step forward into growth or back into safety. Well, when you go forward into growth, it is scary. But that's what I did. And the next level, the fourth level of awareness, is individual. This is where you want to express your uniqueness as a human being. And as you do this, you require more discipline. And discipline is the next level of awareness. Discipline is when we have the ability to give ourselves a command and then follow it. The discipline I learned in the Navy, looking back, was really nothing short of punishment. It wasn't discipline at all. Real discipline is where you give yourself a command and then follow it. By doing that, we move to the next level of awareness, which is experience. This is where learning truly comes in. You see, learning is not just gathering information and repeating it. Learning is when you consciously entertain information, you get emotionally involved in it, you step out and act on it, and you change the end result. The conscious experience of the change in result from that type of behavior is really what learning is all about. And through the experience, you move to the final stage in awareness, which is mastery. We have moved ahead. We have moved into a new world. Now, the information that Earl shares with us here is of utmost importance. He begins by saying, "We know that our young man has tremendous abilities and potentialities intrinsically his own. There is no other human being on earth exactly like him. We know there are wide, wide fields of interest which, if he knew about them, would change his life to one of excitement and make him a real contributor to the economy instead of a feeder. All too often, he walks down a narrow road, yet right in his own job, and stretching clear to the horizon are the rich, sunlit fields of opportunity. Between him and these fields, however, there's a tall hedge which shields them from view. This hedge is called conformity. And until he breaks through, cuts his way through this thorny barrier, he will never see nor know the joys of living fully extended." But how can we do this? Well, first, we must begin to think. We must look at ourselves objectively for what we really are, distinct individuals with unlimited opportunities for development. Second, we must ask ourselves some questions. Do I want to be like the people I'm following? Are these the people I want my children to be like? I know they're pretty good people, but do they know where they're going? Are they successful? Are they as successful as I want to be? If I continue to go along as I have in the past, where will I be in 5 years from now? Am I operating at or near the peak efficiency? Am I really a professional, or have I been doing just enough to get by? Am I devoting a part of my time each day to thinking of ways and means by which I can increase my contribution? Am I really aware that my rewards in life will always be in exact proportion to my service? Am I following an intelligent course for improving my mind and increasing my knowledge? Do I have a reading and study program? Or do I think I already know enough? I expect my company, my community, and my country to improve with the passing of each year. But what am I doing, personally, to keep pace with this improvement or to exceed it? Have I thought much and told my children about how lucky we are to live in a free society in which we can go where we please without having to ask for permission, work where we please and at the job of our choice, vote and worship as we please and say what we please? Am I aware of the responsibilities that go with freedom, the responsibility to produce as much as I can so my freedom may be maintained, the responsibility to become so effective as a person that even if time should become bad for a while, I could go right on providing for my family through the crises? Third, when I get up in the morning, do I know exactly what it is I'm working towards? Have my life and my work a clear direction and worthwhile purpose, or am I simply marking time and going along with the crowd? Am I motivated by what I really want, or am I mass motivated? Well, now, I am going to suggest that you stop right at this point and begin to think. I want to suggest that you visualize this image of the stick person. And then I want you to relate that you become the stick person. I want you to see yourself with a marvelous mind, and I want you to imagine that there's a beautiful energy that flows into your consciousness, and you can choose any thought you want. You just pluck them out of the ether and pull them into your consciousness, and you can build an idea. You can choose the thoughts that will build the image of whatever it is that you want in life, and then you can become it. Now let's see how Earl brings this lesson into a close. He quotes Harry Emerson Fosdick, who once wrote, "No horse gets anywhere until he is harnessed. No steam or gas ever drives anything until it is confined. No Niagara ever turned into light and power until it is channeled. And no life ever grows great until it is focused, dedicated, and disciplined." You see, it's actually easier to win. All we have to do is know some of the rules and follow them. P.G. Hamerton wrote, "A strong life is like a ship of war, which has its own place in the fleet and can share in its strength and discipline, but can also go forth alone to the solitude of the infinite sea. We ought to belong to society and have our place in it, but be capable of an individual existence outside of it. And it's never too late. For with a purpose, a goal, a person will frequently do more and travel further in a year than they might otherwise in a lifetime without one." Now you're going to find, as I did, that if you decide on a purpose, you choose a goal, and you begin to think, you're going to find it's easier to win. This is Bob Proctor, and thank you.